Hello everyone and welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show in which we demonstrate how everything has a history, even the most unexpected of subjects, like bananas, tails and leaves.
Ooh, I think we should, since it's autumn coming along, Sam, maybe something on leaves would be good.
It's a wonderful idea. That's one of the best ideas you've had for some time.
Is it?
A history of leaves.
I'm full of good ideas. Of course, for me, it will be leaves of manuscripts. However, we could do bricks, hicks and slicks, tricks, ricks and licks. I know we've done the history of tongues, haven't we? But licking is great. It's, of course, all about the rise of the gummed envelope. Of course it is. Everything, Sam, as you know, comes back to the history of the letter.
Stationery, generally.
Exactly. However, for the moment, we will be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, that the history of trust is in fact all about 17th century Dutch merchants, atrocities against First Nation children in Canada, stolen generations in Australia, and the extension of credit and trade networks. Who knew, Sam? Sounds fascinating. Or that the history of jam is in fact all about World War II, rationing and the Women's Institute, think jam and Jerusalem. It's also about 17th century recipes. It's about empire, sugar, colonial trade and slavery. Of course it is.
Wonderful stuff. Two excellent topics. You're probably wondering who is telling you all this. Of my fellow presenter, if he were a cocktail maker and history was gin, he would knock you up the best French 75 you've ever had. That's 10 millilitres of gin, 10 of orange liqueur, 10 millilitres of archival research and a top-up of fizzy creativity of your choice, but I would recommend a sparkling Prosecco of the past. He is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University's Professor James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, and I can imagine where you're orienting yourself in this gin-related episode. However, for the moment, you may well be wondering, who is that unattributed voice so ably helping Professor Daybell co-pilot this excellent episode? Well, let's just say that if he were a gin-related historian, and this comes with an apology because I was not feeling particularly original at all, but he'd only be William Hogarth himself, he of the Gin Lane picture. Such a scourge is he of the evils of drinking in charge of history. So brilliant is he at uncovering in sober detail the history in the archives. Yes, you've guessed it, is the famous historical adventurer himself, Dr. Sam Willis. Do you think I got away with that one?
Just.
Yeah, well, I was making it up on the fly as I was there.
Often do. Guys, hello. Welcome, everyone. We are doing the history of gin, which is a wonderful subject and allows us to rampage all over in the past. I immediately thought about Hogarth. I think a lot of people would and the horrors of poverty and gin drinking as it took over the streets of London in the 18th century.
Do you know what?
But I wanted to get away from that, and I ended up in all sorts of different places. What were you going to say, James?
Do you know what? I was going to say that I've just come back, hot foot, down the A38 from Plymouth, where I attended a seminar by the chief medical officer of this country, the United Kingdom, Chris Whitty, who is an extraordinary individual. But I was just struck because I knew that I was going to be recording this episode on gin. And what did he have up on one of his slides but Hogarth's Gin Lane? Because the talk was all about coastal communities and it's all about the big data research that the University of Plymouth has been doing. And a brilliant colleague of mine, Sheena Asthana, in the medical school, about the health-related problems that coastal communities are facing, because you get a particular kind of demographic in there. And one of the things that, you know, alcoholism, you know, and social disparity and all those kind of those sort of ailments that you associate with, you know, impoverished regions, you see in, you know, in coastal communities. And gin was one of them. So drinking and alcoholism. And that was one of the things that I was hoping to talk about today. I see it rather, the sort of gin craze in the 18th century, I see it rather as a sort of almost like the crack epidemic in America and California in the 1980s. So I was going to talk about that. I was also going to talk a little bit about gin palaces and the architecture of indulgence, the architecture of intoxication.
Mm. Sounds very good indeed. Well, let me start. I just want to talk about the Dutch physician Franciscus Sylvius, 1614 to 72. He's one, a really interesting person. He's one of the earliest defenders of the theory of circulation of the blood in the Netherlands. He's often credited with the invention of gin in the 17th century. But beware, because this theory is rejected by many historians, because there's actually proof of juniper-flavoured alcoholic beverages and medicines as well long before this. Some believe that gin actually has its origins in the monasteries of Italy. I think my point to begin with, James, is that if you were just doing a straight history of gin, even that is actually very contested, which I'm not particularly surprised about, because there's something so yummy about it. But thinking about how you might explore this in a more unexpected way, being a good maritime and naval historian, I decided to immediately just go and explore a little bit of the history of Dutch courage, which is linked to the idea of increasing your bravery by drinking gin or possibly other spirits. And it's believed to link back to the Anglo-Dutch Wars. So that's the second half of the 17th century. The first bit of that, so 1650 to 74-75, or the 30 Years' War, which was a bit earlier, kind of a generation earlier, and it was more focused on mainland Europe, whereas the Anglo-Dutch Wars of the 1650s were very much naval and maritime. And it's actually believed to refer either to the use of gin by the Dutch or perhaps by British as well, so people to calm themselves before battle, which immediately raised a very obvious question, James. It's, what alcoholic drink of choice would you have before entering battle?
What would I have?
I would have a mezcal Negrini, which is 1 ounce of mezcal, 1 ounce of Campari, 1 ounce of sweet vermouth, and it completely levels you.
I'm not sure what I'd have. Something I probably wouldn't. Well, I wouldn't turn to alcohol, I don't think. Oh. I think I'd want a shot of coffee or something to sort of give me, you know, energy and not sort of, you know, dampen me if I were going into battle. What a horrifying thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's interesting kind of how and why this has even come about. The first time it's actually written down, there's any written example of it, comes from the trial of a British naval captain. But many generations after, this is in 1797. This is about the Battle of Camperdown. So it's a battle between the Royal Navy and the Dutch. It's a really interesting period, actually. Many people think that the era of the Napoleonic Wars and fighting and the French Revolution is all about fighting the French at sea. But of course, it's much more complicated than that. We're fighting all sorts of people, including the Dutch. And Camperdown itself is widely considered one of the hardest fleet battles in history. Anyway, at the trial of Captain Williams in a court-martial, he was asked, "Do you recollect during the time we were firing, my saying to you that I was sorry to see a person a little intoxicated at such a time, but as we were fighting on the Dutch coast, I suppose he thought it necessary to lay in a stock of Dutch courage." So what we got here is kind of an implication or perceived drinking culture of the Dutch. There's another actual reference to something similar here. This is from Edmund Waller. He's an English poet in the 17th century, so 1606 to 1687. So more than a century before that previous quote I had. And he doesn't actually use the phrase Dutch courage, but he certainly implies it. And he's writing about a naval battle between the English and the Dutch called the Battle of Lowestoft in 1665. And it's a pamphlet called Instructions to a Painter for the Drawing of the Posture and Progress of His Majesty's Forces at Sea, under the command of His Highness, and together with the battle and victory obtained over the Dutch, June the 3rd, 1665. And he writes, "The Dutch, their wine and all their brandy lose, disarmed of that from which their courage grows." Now, the exact kind of reasons behind the phrase is pretty unclear, but it's certainly, I think, disparaging of the Dutch. That's the kind of the bottom line, the takeaway point. So there you are, James, a bit of chat about Dutch courage.
Oh, Sam, that's excellent. We love a bit of Dutch courage. So I wanted to explore this phenomenon of the gin craze in the 18th century. And this was something that I knew little about. I'd read various sort of bits and pieces about it. But just reading through it again and doing a little bit of research for this, it did strike me the sort of modern parallels that we have today with some of the... If you look at, as I was saying earlier, if you look at the spread of crack cocaine in the United States in the 1980s. I mean, this seems to be exactly the kind of situation that you have in the, in the 18th century with the rise of gin. And it's something that also connects to our present, and I talked already about the connection to coastal communities and the sort of impoverished areas in the country and the prevalence of alcoholism, and I think we are struggling with alcoholism in throughout the world. You think about how young people nowadays play sort of all sorts of drinking games. The 40% rise in liver disease, as reported by a parliamentary heptology group. This is something that's quite extraordinary. And from its entry into British society, particularly in London, from the 1680s onwards, we then see quite how it proliferates within towns. It is so incredibly cheap to buy. There are gin shops almost everywhere. And this leads to all kinds of problems. It leads to ensuing moral panic, but also there are concerns around public health, around public order, issues around the kinds of behaviour that's being exhibited by the poor, particularly also by women. And then what we have is a crackdown. So a series of five major acts are passed trying to control gin in almost sort of 25 years, between 1727 and 1751. And I think you can see a parallel that this is a kind of, this is a sort of 18th century war on drugs in the same way that you've got in certain parts of the world nowadays. I think the extraordinary thing, though, is that people didn't quite know what were going to be the consequences of this. When it comes to England from Holland, it is actually seized with some enthusiasm. And there are people who benefit from it. The distilling industry, for example, receives certain favours from government officials. There are landowners who are able to take advantage of the demand for corn, for example. So all of these are real catalysts for driving this gin craze. And then it's not until, several decades later that they realise exactly what is wrong with it, what it actually does. And, when you think about it from a social point of view, just the ease with which you're able to get it. Apparently in London, it was within everyone's reach, and throughout London, every fifth house had some catered for gin in some way. There's a superb little article on gin and Georgian London in History Today, which is by, let me just scroll down, I'm looking at it here, Thomas Maples. And it's a superb little piece that sort of outlines all of the sort of social ills that are associated with it. The legislation that we see, these acts of Parliament that are put through trying to control gin consumption, which fail almost uniformly, because people enjoy getting inebriated very cheaply. And there are riots connected with not being able to get gin. So people are becoming, addicted to it. Henry Fielding, the novelist, is quite vocal in the criminal elements that arise from it. And in an inquiry into causes of the late increase in robbers, he argues that basically the major cause of this crime is on gin consumption and drunkenness upon the poorer classes. He stated that drunkenness was a vice by no means to be consumed as a spiritual offence alone, since it was hoped many temporal mischiefs arise from it. Wretches, he continues, are often brought before me charged with theft and robbery, whom I'm forced to confine before they are in condition to be examined, and when they have afterwards become sober, I have plainly perceived from the state of the case that the gin alone was the cause of the transgression. Now, if you go from something like that and you start having a look at the court records, you only need to go to something like Old Bailey Proceedings Online. And if you have a look at this wonderful online resource for the 1700s and put in a search term, you will find that about 1100 or so court cases feature crimes that were committed where gin played some kind of role in it. So people were either fighting over it, they were inebriated from it, they were in a sort of gin, you know, gin shop. And there's one case that I want to tell you about that I came across. And this is from March 1734, when it goes into the Old Bailey courtroom in London. And it relates to a single mother called Judith Defoe, who had been charged of murdering her own daughter. And the court proceedings relay how Defoe, and I quote, took the child into the fields and stripped it, tied a linen handkerchief hard about its neck to keep it from crying, and then laid it in a ditch. Now, this Judith is a particularly sort of, you know, wretched figure in this trial. She's somebody who is addicted to gin. She's an addicted gin drinker. And she's asked to explain why she did this and how this occurred. And she, her story is that she had intended to sell her daughter's coat and stay for a shilling and the petticoat and stockings for a groat in order to purchase a quartern of gin. So this whole thing of like taking her child into the fields, taking off all its clothes, tying a handkerchief round its mouth so that it can't cry out, is basically so that she can get its clothes off and sell them so that she can feed her addiction. And of course, you know, a jury hearing that kind of story finds her guilty and punishes her with death. She happens to be pregnant at the time, and she makes a plea for pardon because of the unborn child inside her. And this plea was ignored, and the execution went ahead completely as planned. And in the end, so, you know, I suppose what this is the drinking of gin, the consumption of gin, the addiction to gin had basically caused her to murder her own daughter. And, you know, and this, it's cases like this that then feed into some of the serious political responses that we have to gin. And this is sort of part and parcel of the background that then leads to these anti-gin laws that we see throughout the first half of the 18th century. So there we are, Sam. Criminality and gin.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, a terrible story of something leading to murder their own daughter. My dad's addiction to gin led him to blow up a bit of our house. Quite an extreme way of putting it. But I was also thinking, as we do with Histories of the Unexpected, often apply it to our own lives, our own histories, to sort of gain inspiration about how to think of something. And I remember walking into our larder when I was sort of 7 or 8 or something, and it was a little cold room just off the kitchen. And I went in there, and the whole thing was covered in purple liquid. But Dad had made, he tried to make slow gin. So, you know, gin mixed with a bit of sugar and a bit of sloes, those wonderful little purple fruit you get on blackthorn hedges. And it had exploded. Such was the pressure inside of the fermentation. And I do remember that very vividly. I was quite shocked at you know, something being left on its own and made of such lovely natural ingredients could actually cause a quite frightening explosion. I mean, there were shards of glass jammed into the doors.
Slow gin is such a waste of gin, I think. Don't you think? It's a waste of good gin.
I like it. I really like it. It's a bit sweeter and a bit smoother. I've always loved it. Yeah. So no, I won't agree with you there.
From the age of seven, when you licked it off the walls.
Yeah. I was fed on. But I suddenly thought, I tell you what, let's look into slow gins. Because what actually is going on there? There are some really interesting cultural implications of slow gin. The first point is that, yes, okay, it's made, you go out, you pick your slows, you mix it with your gin and a bit of sugar. So there are three fairly major ingredients, all of which have massive historical implications. Gin, sugar, and slows. And I'll just leave your listeners' minds to tick over what those might be. So it produced a sweet sort of purplish drink, and it was known as rather disparagingly as the poor man's port. So if you think about the 18th or 19th centuries and where proper fortified spirits had come from, like port or Madeira, there's a clue for you. It's all to do with colonialism and maritime trade as well. The island of Madeira, you know, produced Madeira. And so you need to be able to import it. It's quite expensive. You need the appropriate land where you can grow the ingredients to make the drink. But slows are properly accessible to everyone. You can walk out pretty much anywhere in the English countryside, find a hedge, find some slows, stick it in some gin with a bit of sugar, and off you go. The link with sugar, obviously, is interesting. You can't make it without sugar. And as it was known as a poor man's sort of version of port, the point about this is you don't just make it with sugar. What mattered is that you made it with affordable sugar. So this isn't from a period when sugar was insanely expensive. It was from a period when sugar was mass produced in British colonies by slaves. So the ability to make the slow gin means you have to have the affordable sugar, which then, of course, you know, links to the enormously and well-established slave economy of the 18th century. But the final thing about it, which I thought was particularly interesting, is that you get slows from blackthorns, right? From a hedge. And that should make you go, ooh, but why are there so many hedges made of blackthorn in the English countryside?
And oh, it does, Sam. It does.
The answer to that, of course, are the Enclosure Acts of the 17th and 18th centuries. So what you've got here is the cordoning off of what was previously common land for private agriculture. And what's the easiest and quickest way of making a hedge? A proper barrier hedge. And the answer, of course, is with blackthorn, because it's spiky. So that is why there are so many blackthorn hedges around the English countryside. That is why there were so many slows around. So it's all to do with privatisation of nothing less than the English countryside itself. Nevertheless, once you've got that and you've got your cheap imported sugar, you have all of the facilities in place for people to produce slow gin easily, quickly, and, of course, cheaply. So a fascinating little history there, which takes us right across the Atlantic to the slave economies of the Caribbean, and also to the privatisation of common land and you know, the establishment of mass farming and the huge changes to the English landscape which happened between the 16th and the 18th.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
centuries.
Sam Willis, gin is nothing less than an explanation for the enclosure movement. That's amazing. Who knew?
Who knew?
Your talk about your exploding larder has made me want to talk about one of my own most pleasurable experiences of gin in recent years. A few years ago, before lockdown, there was a charming custom in a little village nearby where I live in Topsham called a safari supper. And the idea is that you all, you basically go on safari to have dinner. So you all turn up, partners turn up at one house in the village. And then you go there for a welcome drink. Gin was not included there. But then you get given a little slip of paper and you're told where to go for your starter. And so you cycle off around the village to your hosts. And then you turn up with another three couples. So there are eight of you there. And you have your first course. And then towards the end of the first course, you're then given another slip of paper and which tells you where you are going for your main. And so you sort of pootle off, meet another sort of six people. You're given another slip. And then you go somewhere for dessert with another sort of random six people. None of these people you actually necessarily know. Some of them you will. But then everyone at around just before midnight ends up at the house, at another house, a fifth house at the very end, which is the house where everyone congregates to have a sort of carouse into the early hours. And on this occasion, when we turned up, we were greeted by the most extravagant range of gins you have ever seen in your life. There must have been a dozen bottles. This couple were supreme gin aficionados. And what struck me was it wasn't just the variety of local gins and gins that have been flavoured with this, that and the other, but also the variety of tonics. This got me thinking, of course, about architecture and the role that architecture, I suppose, plays in the consumption of gin. And so what I'm going to think about is a sort of spatial approach to gin. And you think of these in the 18th century gin cellars and gin shops cropping up everywhere. And these people, these are really sort of improvised things. It could be in people's sort of, almost in people's sort of personal homes. These people have an incredibly bad reputation. So, for example, a spokesperson from the London Grand Jury that was sort of looking into this claimed in 1736 that most of the murders and robberies lately committed have been laid and concentrated at gin shops. And Mandeville, in his Fable of the Bees, writes of that he knows of no more miserable shift for a livelihood than selling gin at gin shops. So these are the sort of crack dealers of the 18th century, to sort of continue that motif that I was on about before. Mandeville then goes on to sort of note the supposed good qualities of a good gin cellar, writing that a gin cellar must in the first place be of a watchful and suspicious as well as a bold and resolute temper, that he may not be imposed upon by cheats and sharpers, nor outbullied by the oaths and imprecations of hackney coachmen and foot soldiers. And he continues, in the second, he ought to be a dabster. I liked that because that's your nickname for me. A dabster at gross jokes and loud laughter, and have all the winning ways to allure customers and draw out their money, and be well versed in the low jests and railleries the mob makes use of to banter prudence and frugality. He must be affable and obsequious to the most despicable, always ready and officious to help a porter down with his load, shake hands with a basket woman, pull off his hat to an oyster wench, and be familiar with a beggar with patience and good humour, he must be able to endure the filthy actions and viler language of nasty drabs and the lewdest rake-hells, and with a frown or at least aversion, bear with all the stench and squalor, noise and impertinence that the utmost indigence, laziness and ebriety can produce in the most shameless and abandoned vulgar. So you really get a sense of what these sort of gin shops are like. But then on the back of that, I read the most extraordinary article by a scholar called Julius Skelly, and it's entitled Addictive Architecture, The Crystal Palace, Gin Palaces and Women's Desire. And it builds from the 1851 Great Exhibition in London at Crystal Palace. And one of the things that critics of the time complain about, they are concerned about the alcohol consumption at Crystal Palace, that it would function as an alternative to the public house for working class people. And actually, Victorians were concerned that the opulence, the splendour of something like Crystal Palace was a hugely, I quote, addictive form of architecture. It was like a huge, giant public drinking space. And that they argue that the structure of it, the very sort of fabric of it, the built environment of it, was to sort of encourage people to seek consumption of alcohol. And the big concern here is that with the rise of these Victorian palaces, these gin palaces, the real concern was the impact that it had on female consumers, that they were, you know, they were encouraged to go into these kinds of places, you know, where they would frequent with dangerous sort of types. And now part of this then is part of the essay is around the Crystal Palace and the Great Exhibition of London in 1851 and the Gin Palace. And the idea, the main argument is that these are seen as public drinking spaces that are often criticised for seducing drinkers with their ornate decoration and shop-style windows. So these aesthetic accoutrements, you know, are what allures people in. The famous architectural historian Marc Giroard argues that the term gin palace was used around 1834 to describe gin shops in this new flamboyant style. And if you look at the characteristics of them, they're characterised by gas lighting, large plate glass windows, beautiful counters, decorative elements, you know, incorporating iron and wood. We both ate out at the Ivy in Exeter last week. And I can imagine it's something of the opulence of the bar space there that we're seeing in these gin palaces. These are a far cry from the kind of gin shops and dram shops that I've been talking about earlier on in the 18th century, that are these sort of real cesspit places. And then the argument then goes on to look at the fabric of some of these places. And there's a beautiful account in a tract called The Witch of Endor and the Dram Shop, where it describes the exterior of it. And this is published in the 1830s. If you observe the dram shops, you will see that attention has been paid to the point of concealment. In the first place, the inner doors are provided with a spring so as to shut again as soon as the customers are entered. In the second place, the windows are constructed as to render it impossible for passengers without to observe what is going on within. In complete contrast to this, the Crystal Palace is something that is opulent, that is open, that is doesn't hide it away, but actually is encouraging people to come in. What you've got in these sort of gin shops is a sort of more darkened sort of place that traps people inside. Whereas if you look at the gin palaces, it's about the lighting, the facade, you know, that luring working class people, especially women, inside into their depths. And the concerns with these are manifold. It's concerned about the consumption of alcohol. It's the concern about the presence of women in public, you know, either desiring alcohol or consuming alcohol. And that, of course, has all sorts of issues around, you know, wanting to control female behaviour, around prostitution, around immorality, all of those kinds of things that can be seen to take place within these kinds of institutions. So I thought that was a wonderful article. I really enjoyed reading it. It's a really sort of, you know, cutting edge example of, I suppose, sociocultural history meets this sort of architectural built environment spatial approach to the past. There we are, Sam.
Amazing. And the idea of, you know, designing buildings specifically to entice people in, I think, is wonderful.
Somebody should do the history of a Wetherspoons. You know, what is it about the Wetherspoons that sort of lures you in? We are in the capital of Wetherspoons. And by the University of Exeter, there is the most opulent Wetherspoons you have ever seen in your life. This is not your sort of regular Wetherspoons drinkery with cheap alcohol. It has cheap alcohol, but it is also in the most opulent orangery, one of the most beautiful buildings in Exeter, I would imagine, Sam.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. Huge gardens. Good. Yes.
A nice place to hang out under the pine trees. Guys, I hope you've enjoyed that, our little history of gin. There's much more stuff coming. We're doing the history of dolls next, so you've got that to look forward to. Do please follow me on social media. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis. And if you're interested in the history of the sea, maritime history, please follow the Mariner's Mirror podcast.
And you can follow me on Twitter at James Dable. You can follow the podcast at Unexpected Pod. We're also on Instagram and Facebook, and we have a lovely website, historiesoftheunexpected.com. And if you want to be a patron, go to Patreon, and we have a Histories of the Unexpected page there if you'd like to support us in what we are doing in this little podcast that we have.
Absolutely. Any help you can offer will be hugely gratefully received, and it will allow us to increase the number of episodes that we produce so we can change the way people think about the past. That is nothing less than our goal. Thank you all so much for listening, guys. We'll be back again soon. Cheerio.
Bye, guys.